I'd like to introduce Catherine McKenzie. Catherine isn't already part of the network or the executive, but is one of the invited guests to address us on behalf of the New South Wales Ombudsman's Office. And I've confessed I've had the pleasure of working with Catherine, wearing other hats with the Ombudsman's Office and the Child Death Review Team and related functions. And it's a great pleasure for me to welcome her here today. And would you please join me in welcoming her?
Hi, everyone. I've just taken the somewhat controversial position of not having a PowerPoint today. I thought, I've got 10 minutes. All right, no PowerPoint. I thought, I've got 10 minutes and I'm just going to take the opportunity to have a chat to you about a little bit about what we do in reviewing the deaths of people with disabilities in care, but really to talk to you about, communicate some of the key messages from that work and talk to you a little bit about some of the areas that we're particularly concerned with at the moment and that we're doing some work towards. So just briefly, I know that other people from my area have spoken at ACI forums before about what we do, so I'll just briefly cover it for people that haven't had it before. Unlike a lot of other Ombudsman's Office, we have a whole range of other kind of community services related functions, and one of them that we've got the privilege of having is that we review the deaths of people with disabilities in care, so people that live in accommodation services provided or funded by ADEC, and also people living in assisted boarding houses in New South Wales. So we get around 100 deaths notified to us each year. It's generally, you know, 85% are people in what we call disability services, so ADEC provided or funded accommodation, and 15% boarding house residents. So our functions are, it's primarily to, it's aimed at obviously preventing or reducing the likelihood of premature deaths of people with disabilities in care. Part of how we do our work is that we keep a register of deaths that contains a huge amount of information on the individuals that have died, and we analyse that information. We look at obviously the circumstances of those individuals and raise issues where necessary about those particular matters, but our core functions are about the systemic work and looking at the information arising from those deaths on a much bigger picture and looking at trends and patterns relating to those particular matters. We report to Parliament on our work every 2 years, including our recommendations and agency progress towards implementing those recommendations. We also try to communicate the key messages from our work through some quite garish fact sheets that I know are at the front table, so please grab some if you can, to communicate to certainly to direct care staff, but also to GPs and others about the key messages from our work. And we also do community education with services and others as needed, and try to promote that as much as possible. So some of the key things from our work, and that wouldn't surprise you at all, are that people with disabilities in care die at a much younger age than the general population. On average, it's 30 years younger than the general population. We obviously find some deaths that are preventable. We talk about preventability through our work as being on a scale, so we don't usually talk about deaths as being not preventable. It's just that some deaths have greater elements of preventability than others, and we certainly do find some that have quite a large number of have more preventable elements. And they're particularly deaths from unnatural causes, so deaths from choking, traffic accidents, drowning, etc. They're the minority of deaths, but they are preventable deaths, and we do focus quite a bit on those deaths. We also have the vast majority are natural, what they're called natural cause deaths, including respiratory diseases. So a lot of people with disabilities in care die from causes such as aspiration pneumonia, pneumonia itself, epilepsy-related deaths, and cancers, including bowel cancer. So we look at those deaths and identify where there are opportunities to intervene earlier or to take different steps that potentially would have resulted in a different outcome. What I wanted to talk to you briefly about today are a couple of really key issues that have stood out to us from the over 10 years that we've been reviewing the deaths of people with disabilities in care. And where we're headed with some of this work. So one of the major areas that has particularly stood out to us, and I know, again, wouldn't be a surprise to you in the audience, is around the coordination of healthcare and support for people with disabilities. And some of the key areas for us are around the support that individuals get to facilitate their access to medical treatment. One of the things that we highlighted in our last report that we released early last year was the number of people whose behavioural decisions affected their medical treatment and health, including people who refused to attend medical appointments, including GP and specialist appointments, were resistant to physical examination, tests or procedures such as blood tests, mammogram, colonoscopy, ECG, refused to follow medical advice or health recommendations, including not using a CPAP machine for sleep apnea, refusing medication, not following swallowing requirements, discharging themselves again, out of hospital early, declining surgery and other treatments such as surgery to insert a peg or excise a tumour. In the majority of the cases, their refusal of treatment, lack of cooperation with tests or exams, or refusal to attend health appointments appeared to be based on factors other than informed, them making an informed decision to do so, and appeared to be based on factors such as their dislike of hospitals, their mental health at the time, or their aversion to being touched. It was not always clear to us what actions had been taken by disability or health services staff to actively work with and assist the person to overcome their objections or to make it an easier process for them, such as making sure they were accompanied by someone that they liked and trusted, gradual and repeated introduction to the test that they would be having or to the hospital that they would be going to. We found that the impact on individuals was sometimes very significant, including missing out on critical treatment and delayed diagnosis of life-threatening conditions. In addition, we saw that sometimes the person's refusal and their behaviour in response to attempts to examine them or to provide treatment affected the medical or support decisions that were made. For example, that included appointments not being made to undertake health checks such as dental or eye examinations because of a perception that the person wouldn't be able to cope with it. The other area that's of concern for us and that we've reported on for a long period of time is the support for people with disabilities when they're in hospital. And our reviews continue to reinforce the need for person-centred, coordinated and cooperative approach between disability and health services and family where relevant to provide effective support to people with disabilities while they're in hospital. Particularly to people in relation to people whose behaviour and potential non-compliance with treatment affects outcomes for them, such as people that tend to pull out cannulas, refuse oxygen medications, don't like their temperature or pulse checked, don't want to have physical exams or tests. And the other area for us around that's important around coordination of healthcare and support is the transfer of care from hospital to home. Obviously, given the health and support needs of many people with disabilities, it's important that their discharge from hospital to home is planned and coordinated, and we don't always see that. Our reviews continue to identify people for whom the transfer of care was largely inadequate, and for some people the impact of that poor discharge planning process was significant. For example, a person who was discharged with significant choking risks, whose discharge plan noted the need for a soft diet, but no guidance was provided to accommodation support staff about what that meant, and the person subsequently died from choking on a sandwich. The other area for us, so that's coordination of healthcare and support is a major issue. The other area for us that's really stood out from our reviews of the deaths of people with disabilities in care is their access to community-based healthcare and programs. And amongst that, we would include chronic disease management programs and support, other out-of-hospital care programs such as hospital in the home, and access to preventative health programs and support. We see low rates of specialist involvement with people with complex and chronic health problems, including infrequent referral to respiratory specialists for people with recurrent and chronic respiratory issues, including chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We see little to no access to chronic disease management or other out-of-hospital programs, despite individuals meeting the criteria for entry to those programs. Instead, what we see is multiple presentations to hospital in relation to their chronic illnesses, again in relation to COPD, but also coronary artery disease, chronic lung disease and diabetes. And our reviews highlight the multiple health risks faced by people with disabilities in care that are related to lifestyle factors, including obesity, poor diet and insufficient physical activity. And for people in boarding houses, obviously face really significant risks associated with high rates of smoking. And there's a really clear need, and we've highlighted in our repeated reports, for health practitioners and support services to take concerted and collaborative action to assist people with disabilities in care to reduce these preventable health risks. Where we're at the moment is that we've been putting these reports out for an extended period of time and raising really consistent messages from those reports and making a lot of recommendations, and we have seen progress from agencies towards meeting those. We see that the point we're at the moment with the disability reform, so disability reform in New South Wales around Stronger Together and the legislative changes, and also reform on a national basis, obviously with NDIS, provides enormous opportunity, but we think that there are also some risks that need to be considered and that we're quite focused on at the moment. So disability reforms across the sector are placing an increased focus, obviously, on mainstream services and increased focus on people with disabilities being able to get access and appropriate support from those mainstream health services in this case. We obviously see that the shift to mainstream health services is appropriate and necessary. However, there are obviously substantial risks for people with disabilities if those mainstream services are not able to meet their needs. What our work has identified is that even with specialist disability services being involved, there are significant gaps in the health support that are provided to individuals. And we do have considerable concerns about the impact on individuals where the shift to mainstream health services may occur at the same time that specialist disability services are withdrawing, if sufficient work hasn't been done to build capacity and ensure appropriate support. We're really pleased to hear David talk about the work that ADIC is doing around or highlighting the importance of capacity development across the sector over the next few years. We think that that's absolutely critical, and our work is showing that it has massive repercussions on individuals if those supports are not in place. We're aware that there's a lot of, and I think today is really illustrative, that there's a lot of people that are all working towards the same outcome, wanting improved health outcomes for people with disabilities, and there's a lot of people doing duplicate work. So, for example, in relation to Medicare locals, you know, we know, and we're one of them, multiple agencies that are sending fact sheets or other information to the same Medicare locals about the same issues, really. And from our end, we just think that potentially there's a need to better coordinate some of the work to have a more targeted approach. And what we're wanting to do is to bring some key parties together. We're intending to hold a disability health roundtable meeting with a small targeted group of agencies to clearly identify roles and responsibilities around ensuring that mainstream health services are in a position to meet the health needs of people with disabilities once NDIS starts on 1 July 2018, and what work needs to be done between now and then to make sure that's the case. We'll be holding that, we're planning on holding that in April, and that's a major focus for us. It's taking the really consistent messages from our work and looking at what actually needs to be done in the context of the disability reforms to make sure that people actually get better health outcomes.
I think we'll take a couple of questions now in thanking Catherine, and then we'll continue with the panel. You have one right at the back there? Yes.
Catherine, thank you very much for speaking. Under the new legislation inclusion bill, I understand that the Ombudsman will have additional powers. I'm concerned about the protections of people once New South Wales is transferred out of service provision. Will your office be integral to the design of the safeguards and under the NDIS, and how can the community take part?
That is a cracker of a question. Our agency is incredibly focused on making sure that appropriate safeguards are put in place under the NDIS. We're doing work with our counterparts in other states and territories, so other disability commissioners in, or complaints commissioners in other states and territories where they exist, and Graeme Innes on a national level, to talk about the minimum safeguards that we think need to be in place. And we've put a document out, and it's on our website, that the commissioners as a whole have developed, that outline the minimum safeguards that we think need to be in place. What we're very keen to do is to move that discussion to a more detailed one about what will be put in place and the core elements under each of those areas and what it needs to look like. We're still at the stage of trying to get those discussions happening. The commissioners as a whole are doing some targeted work to try and get those discussions happening, but work is at a very early, appears to be at a very early point on a national basis around safeguards, the commissioners are doing their bit to try and move that forward. So we're definitely focused on that. We just haven't got a lot of traction on that issue just yet. And look, we're really keen for people to be part of that discussion. I suppose we're looking for a way in, our entry point as a way in at the moment, but would be really keen to engage with anyone who wants to be involved in having those discussions on a national basis. Hi.
Along those lines,
sorry,
traditionally the Ombudsman's office has responded to complaint.
Yes.
If you're going to have a role in terms of the governance and the maintenance of safeguards, how proactive can you really be?
Well, our office is actually different to a lot of other traditional Ombudsman's offices because we, the Community Services Commission merged with the Ombudsman's office at the end of 2002, and so the Community Services Division of the Ombudsman's office has a range of powers and functions that traditional Ombudsman's offices don't have. And some of those obviously relate to our systemic work in reviewing deaths, but it also we have powers for monitoring and review of the delivery of programs and services to people with disabilities. We have broad inquiry powers, so any issues affecting people with disabilities or people eligible to receive disability services, we can look into those issues. So we do have a broader range of powers in addition to complaints, and that's part of what we've said needs to be part of the minimum safeguards is an independent body. We're not saying it should be us, it's whoever, you know, whatever agency is best placed to do that. We're certainly not invested in that, in it being us, but there needs to be an independent agency that has that role in oversighting more broadly what's happening.
Thank you.